May wish to be turning in your Bibles to Ephesians, the fifth chapter. We'll spend a good deal of time there, as the scripture reading suggested this morning, in talking about husbands. As you're turning there, let me once again welcome those of you who are visiting with us, either from other places or perhaps just from the community here. We are grateful for your presence here this morning. The calendar tells us that in two short days, this whole election thing will be over, right? Wednesday morning, we'll wake up, or maybe late Tuesday night, and we'll just know who the winner is, and it'll all be over. And if you believe that, I've got some oceanfront property to sell you. It's been a laborious presidential campaign. It's not been particularly gentle or meek. They seldom are. It'll soon be over, at least the campaigning portion of it. And I know that probably many of you have wondered, as I have wondered, in the midst of all of the controversy that's been going on during this campaign, you have to wonder why anybody would want to be president. Not for the money. The salary is not by any means commensurate with the difficulties and the responsibilities that go with that office. If you become president, you become the target of unbalanced persons who feel frustrated at the ballot box and so decide that they're going to change American politics, the direction of our country, by means of a weapon or something of that nature. If you become president, you will enjoy the stress of making decisions that will affect not only the welfare of this country, but because of our stature in the world, the welfare of the world in many cases. And if you become president, you will become the recipient of strident criticism. It doesn't make any difference what you do. If you go one way, you'll be criticized by people for that. And if you go the other way, you'll be criticized for other folks for doing that. Why would anybody want to be president? Well, there may be a number of reasons for that. But I would suggest to you that to balance all of those negative things as I've presented them, being elected as a president not only brings these awesome responsibilities, but it is a tremendous honor to have the confidence of your fellow citizens placed in you. And it provides tremendous opportunity to do good and to help others in this country. And I would suggest to you that in somewhat the same way, maybe we don't see it in the same magnitude, and that may be our fault, but in somewhat the same way, a man is honored by the wife who agrees, the woman agrees to be his wife. She elects him. I used to think that the men chose the women. Yeah, several of the guys are saying, no. I thought I was chasing her and then she caught me. And I've learned that's the truth. We think we're asking and they're agreeing. That's what happens in so many cases. And when a woman says, yes, I will marry you, she is honoring a man in ways that many men never really do perceive. And husbands have tremendous responsibilities. We'll talk about some of them this morning. But that position, that role, also brings with it great opportunities to do good. I'm going to talk about the husband this morning. But if you're visiting with us and you feel like maybe there needs to be some things said about the other half of this equation, rest assured, we will talk about wives very shortly also. I was kidding with Jim prior to the scripture reading. He said, you know, I've got verse 22. That's the one about submissive wives. He said, I've got that one underlined in my Bible. Well, this morning we're underlining a different verse. We're underlining the one that talks to husbands and talks about their responsibilities in the marital relationship. I want to emphasize the husband's role as a leader. We will talk about him in the term in terms of his love for his wife, but I'm using that only as a means to get to where I want to go, and that is to talk about the husband as the leader of the family. But I want to say some things in maybe a practical way at the very end, in terms of how the husband can fulfill his leadership role. If you're in Ephesians, the fifth chapter, you will note that in verse 25, the responsibility to love is given to husbands. I love Ephesians 5. Paul addresses wives first and then husbands. And of all the things that he could say to either one of the spouses in this relationship, he gives basically only one major responsibility to each. He says to the wives, wives, you submit to your husbands. And he says to the husbands, husbands, you love your wives. There are other passages, we'll just note a few, that talk about other responsibilities, at least in a more specific way. Love is really the fulfillment of all of these responsibilities. But it's interesting that he just picks, Paul does, one responsibility, and that's all he says, essentially, in terms of the general or most broad responsibility of each. And to husbands, he says, in verse 25, love your wives. But he goes on to suggest that the husband's wife, love ought to be like the love that Christ has for the church. It should be a sacrificial love. You know, that's easy to understand when we talk about Jesus. He gave his life for sinful man, for the church. And marriage doesn't frequently call upon us to literally give up our lives, but there are so many different ways in which one puts the welfare of another in front of his own, and each of them represents sacrificial love. That's what this is talking about. Furthermore, Christ's love was purposeful, that he might sanctify and cleanse her with the washing of water by the word, verse 26 says, that he might present her to himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that she should be holy and without blemish. Christ's love had an objective. It wasn't mindless subservience. He served mankind. He loved us with the intention of cleansing us, purifying us, sanctifying us. And the husband's love ought likewise to be purposeful. Furthermore, the husband is admonished to love their wives even as their own bodies in verse 28. So husbands ought to love their own wives as their own bodies. Verse 29, for no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as the Lord does the church. And so Paul makes the observation that those who love themselves, and most of us do, that's natural and normal, we take care of ourselves, we nourish ourselves, we cherish ourselves in the sense that we do those things that are necessary for our own well-being. He says, well, husbands, you ought to love your wives the same way you would love yourself. And then he makes an interesting observation in 28. He says, he who loves his wife loves himself. And I believe that statement is born of the fact that when two people become married, they become one flesh. Their lives are now so interdependent, so connected, so intimately connected that they are said to be one flesh. And so the man who loves his wife is in effect loving himself. And there are some practical things that we could say along that line. The man who loves his wife will find in almost every case that she will return that love. And in that sense, he ends up loving himself through the love of his wife. That's just one way of looking at it. There are so many other passages that talk about the responsibility of husbands. For instance, we could talk about 1 Timothy the 5th chapter, just from a practical standpoint, what's involved in loving one's wife and family. That'll cause the husband to provide for his household. Paul says in Colossians the 3rd chapter in verse 19 that husbands ought not to be bitter toward their wives. And I believe that passage may be a little more understandable if we were to look at a few other versions, the way they translate them. The New International Version suggests that husbands should not be harsh with them, that is their wives. The New Revised Standard Version says that husbands should never treat them harshly. It's interesting. Husbands, love your wives and do not be bitter toward them. Wives have just been admonished to submit to their husbands. And many of you are aware of the fact that in company structures, that those who have authority, who are above others, are frequently not very benevolent to those over whom they have control and who are answerable to them, who must submit to them. The boss sometimes doesn't treat the employee the way he should because he's in a power relationship. Husbands are the head, the husband is the head of the wife, and the wife is to submit to the husband. And there is that temptation, that tendency for the husband then to treat his wife harshly because, well, you know, she just has to accept that. That's her role. Paul says, no, don't be bitter against your wives. Peter adds to that, that husbands ought to dwell with their wives with understanding. He says in 1 Peter 3 and verse 7, giving honor to the wife as to the weaker vessel and as being heirs together of the grace of life that your prayers may not be hindered. It's interesting that following a section in which Peter has encouraged the wives to be submissive to their husbands and to be chaste, to be concerned with the inner man, he turns right around then and instructs the husband to be understanding in the way that he lives with his wife. Why? For two reasons. One, giving honor to her, honoring her as the weaker vessel. And I really don't think Peter is talking about the fact that women physically, typically, are weaker than men. I think that's irrelevant here. I think the weaker vessel is in the sense that she willingly submits to the husband. She has taken that role. Husbands, Peter is saying, don't take advantage of that. You dwell with her with understanding that she does that because it's the right thing to do, because that's the way God intends for it to work, for it to be. Don't be harsh with her. You dwell with her with understanding and understand what it means to place your life in the hands of another. And that's what a wife does when she says, I do. She literally has said, you will be my head. I will submit to you. Boy, you want to choose carefully, don't you, ladies? Because I'll just tell you, there are a lot of the male gender running around are just bozos. All present company accepted. And sometimes women find themselves in situations where they have obligated themselves to submit to somebody who doesn't care about them or is not very wise in the way that he lives with her. Husbands, Peter says, dwell with them with understanding. But then he says, you need to remember that you are heirs together. There's a sense in which although she takes the role of the weaker vessel, of the submissive one, you are equal before God in terms of the value of your soul and the plan of salvation. You are heirs together of the grace of life. Peter said there's some consequences for husbands who don't follow these things. Their prayers can be hindered. Well, I said all of that in terms of husbands, love your wives. But it's interesting that back in Ephesians 5, if you're still in that text, Paul begins by saying, wives, submit to your own husbands as to the Lord. For the husband, he writes, is head of the wife, as also Christ is head of the church. Paul does not command the husband to be head of the wife. He observes that fact as a foundation for the exhortation to the wife. Wives, submit to your husbands because your husbands are your heads. The husband is the head of the wife. Husbands are never commanded to force the wife to submit to their headship. They are told to love. Now, as head of the wife, He is also leader of the family. And I would ask you to consider 1 Timothy, the third chapter. This is in the context, the qualifications of elders. But notice, as the domestic qualifications are being discussed, a bishop must be, Paul begins in verse 2. Verse 4, one who rules his own house well, having his children in submission with all reverence. He is not just head of the wife, he is head of the family. His children ought to be in submission to him, even as his wife is. That's his role. That is the qualification that is demanded of elders if they are to serve in a local congregation. But I want you to notice, and I apologize, I've gone one slide too far here. I want you to notice the connection between verses 4 and 5. In verse 5, we're dealing with a parenthetical statement. Paul is explaining the purpose of this qualification in verse 4. He says, a man who's going to be an elder has to rule his own house well. His children have to be in submission with all reverence. For, here's the reason, for if a man does not know how to rule his own house, how will he take care of the church of God? Now, sometimes what we do, particularly if we're talking about the qualifications of elders, is we'll talk about how a father should behave, and we'll suggest now there's got to be some connection with the way that elders rule, with the way that a father cares for his own house. But I'm not going to do that. I'm going the other way. I want to suggest to you that if we want to talk about how a father ought to behave, we could look from how an elder ought to behave, how he ought to rule the flock, and say something about the way that he ought to behave, or the way husbands ought to behave and fathers ought to behave in their own homes. Well, we know something about the way elders ought to rule the local congregation. In 1 Peter the 5th chapter, in verse 3, the passage that you have already seen, in verse 3, having entrusted them with shepherding the flock of God which is among you, Peter continues saying, nor as being lords over those entrusted to you, but being examples to the flock. At the same time that elders have authority, and I think that's clearly implied by the word rule as it is used over in 1 Timothy 5 and in other passages, their authority is not to be used in an overbearing way. That seems to be the concept of not being lords over those entrusted. There's a balance here. Now, my point is this. Even as elders are not to be self-willed, according to Titus 1:7, and they're not to be despots over the local congregation, they have authority in their role as God's shepherds over a local flock. And when we look at that, we know something about the way that a father ought to take care of his own house. Because Paul made that connection between the role of the father, 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 4, and the work of the bishop or the elder in verse 5 of 1 Timothy 3. And so I'm suggesting to you that even as we understand that an elder is not to be a despot over the local congregation, a father is not to be a despot over his own house. Not over his wife, not over his children. And there is a great temptation to feel that that authority that has been given to the husband, the father, by God is an overreaching authority, that it allows him to behave in ways that, as Brad suggested, are not fitting for Christians. The husband who behaves as a despot in his home is hardly fitted to lead the local congregation as one of the elders. That's the point that Timothy is hearing from the Apostle Paul in 1 Timothy 3. And we talked about the husband's responsibility to love his wife first, because the command to love his wife helps us understand how he's to lead. He is the head, Paul said. Well, how does he express that authority? How does he lead? He loves. Like the elders, he loves and he leads by example. And we'll say more about that in specifics later. But he encourages his wife's submission through his love. This is not just a lesson for husbands. I know all the wives have been kind of, nudging the men so they don't fall asleep during this one. But this lesson is for husbands in terms of us understanding our responsibility, but it's for wives so they will accept the role of the husband. There are too many families where, if you'll pardon the expression, the woman wears the pants. She wants to take the role that God really gave to the husband. And too many husbands are just willing to say, okay, you do it. It's easier. It's a lesson to young ladies to look for men who are willing to assume that role, who have the courage to stand up and say, I'll lead. And the tenderness to do it the way the Lord instructs. This is a lesson to young men to help them understand, why am I always looking over here? To help them understand, because you guys are closer to marriageable age than some of the other ankle biters. So that you understand what you need to be, how you need to be preparing yourself to be good husbands. I want you to go back to the book of Genesis, to chapter 31. As we talk about the way that a husband can lead his wife, I'm going to make reference to a story in the life of Jacob. I almost hesitate to use this story, because in the story, Jacob is dealing with two wives. And I'm not commending that. The Bible is very clear in the New Testament, let each woman have her own husband and each husband have his own wife. It's singular, singular. There's not a plurality here. But there's something interesting that happens here, particularly in light of the culture of Jacob's day, where the man, the patriarch of his house, when he spoke, that was it. And yet I want you to see something in Genesis 31 at the beginning of the chapter. Jacob is up living in the vicinity of his father-in-law Laban. He has married Laban's daughters, Rachel and Leah. And he's had children. He's spent 20 years with Laban, in fact, at the time that we're talking about. And things have really not gone well for Laban. God has blessed Jacob. Laban wasn't a real fine fella. And God has blessed Jacob. And Laban's sons are resentful of Jacob's good fortune. And they begin to reason that really Jacob is in some way stealing from or cheating their father. He's eating up their inheritance. Verse 2 of Genesis 31. And Jacob saw the countenance of Laban. Indeed, it was not favorable toward him as before. Then the Lord said to Jacob, return to the land of your fathers and to your family, and I will be with you. So Jacob sent and did something strange. He sent and he called Rachel and Leah to the field, to his flock. Brought them out of their house. Brought them out to where he was apparently with the animals, the flocks. And he said to them, I see your father's countenance that it's not favorable toward me as before, but the God of my father has been with me. And you know that with all my might I have served your father. Yet your father has deceived me and changed my wages 10 times, but God did not allow him to hurt me. If he said thus, speckled shall be your wages, then all the flocks bore speckled. And if he said thus, the streaked shall be your wages, then all the flocks bore streaked. So God has taken away the livestock of your father and given them to me. And it happened at the time when the flocks conceived that I lifted my eyes and saw in a dream, and behold, the rams which leaped upon the flocks were streaked and speckled and gray spotted. And the angel of God spoke to me in a dream saying, Jacob, and I said, here am I. He said, lift your eyes now and see all the rams which leap on the flocks are streaked, speckled, and gray-spotted, for I have seen all that Laban is doing to you. I am the God of Bethel, whom you anointed the pillar and where you made a vow to me. Now arise, get out of this land, and return to the land of your family. That may seem like kind of an unrelated reading, but let me tell you that in that culture, Jacob could have said to his wives, pack it up, we're out of here, we're leaving. And they would have just followed him. That's the way things went in that culture. God told him to do it. But what's interesting to me is that here's a husband. Let's look at him from a husband standpoint. Here's a husband who calls his wives out and says, listen, God's told me to leave. I want you to understand why we're leaving. Now, I believe that is an example And I'm not sure that it's a contrived example. That is an example of a husband dwelling with understanding with his wife. He is a leader. He's going to make the decision, but he's letting his wife know, I'm sorry, wives, know why they're leaving. And he explains to them things that they probably already knew, but he's helping them understand the reason for the change in their lifestyle. Now, whatever else you want to say about Jacob as a husband, as a father, that I think is commendable. And I believe what it demonstrates is a considerate leader. As leader of the family, the husband is in a position, in a role of tremendous responsibility and opportunity. Let me tell you, husbands and young men who may contemplate marriage in the future, you are in a fantastically and dreadfully serious position. Because the future of your family will in many ways depend on decisions that you make day by day. As the leader of the family, you will set the course for your family. It's not just your soul salvation that will be affected by your decisions. It'll affect the salvation of those who are following behind you. And I'll tell you that husbands can be responsible and fathers can be responsible for what comes into a home. Husbands and fathers do not need to abdicate their responsibility. Say, well, we just can't help it. You just can't combat the influences. Yes, you can. You can determine what's in your home and what's not in your home. We don't need to give up the battle. And I will tell you that recently I have taken a closer look at that particular thing in my life, in my role as a husband and as a previous father. I guess I'm still a father, but I don't have children at home. The husband is responsible for leading home Bible studies. Think of how many things he can teach his wife and his children, and how many things they can share jointly, how much spiritual strength can be gained if the father will set the course and make sure that that's what this family is going to do. We are going to get together as a family and study the Bible. And yet, time and time, how many times have you seen families where the only instruction that children get from the Bible is what they get when they come to services, when they come to the Bible classes? Because the parents, and particularly the fathers are the ones who are to bring up their children in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord. Fathers have abdicated that responsibility. They turned it over to the Bible class teacher. It wasn't given to the Bible class teacher. It was given to fathers. They're the ones who are to have their children in submission. They're the ones who are to teach and to admonish and to bring their children up in the proper curriculum. Fathers need to be responsible for leading home Bible studies. Husbands need to do that. Husbands and fathers need to be responsible for leading family prayers, setting the course. This is going to be a family that prays about decisions. This is going to be a family that is concerned with other people's welfare. This is a family that consults God and gives thanks for what we have. And I'll tell you, leadership can be a thankless job sometimes. It requires tough decisions and sometimes unpopular decisions. All fathers know that. But the father, the husband, should not only be responsible for prohibiting things that are wrong and sinful from either entering the home or being conducted in the home, but the other side of that is he needs to be encouraging and praising those things that are right. I really sometimes think that fathers, if we're not careful, we see ourselves as the guardians, but that just means keeping things out or stopping things. But our role, our responsibility is much greater than that. Young people, particularly teenagers, and young children also, but particularly teenagers, they need to be encouraged in those things that they're doing right. There are too many times when we have to say no. Are you daft? You can't cut your hair that way. No earrings for you. I think the tattoo is a little much. You're not going to the dance. No, we don't drink alcohol. It's not harmless. No cigarettes. And we see ourselves as constantly saying, no, no, no. But what we ought to be doing is saying, yes. That's right. There needs to be encouragement. There needs to be praise for those decisions and for that behavior that is right and proper. You've been really patient this morning. Let us conclude by saying the husband is to lead his wife and his family. He's head of his wife and his children through love. The husband is the leader of the family. I wanted to stress he's the spiritual leader of the family. Sometimes elders get the idea that their job is to make decisions just about money. And they deal with all kinds of decisions that really have no spiritual import. Some elders do. They are spiritual leaders. That implies some decisions about assets and various things. But they are first and foremost entrusted with shepherding the flock. And they're going to give account for the ones that they are overseeing, that they're ruling. That's the language of Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 17. They are spiritual leaders. Well, in the same way, fathers will make decisions that are, well, do we paint or not to paint? Do we put up borders or not to put up borders? You know, all kinds of things. Do we buy this car or the other car? But he is first and foremost a spiritual leader. And he should be teaching his children, leading his wife, encouraging. But sometimes, obviously, he's going to have to oppose some things that are wrong. May God bless all the fathers, all the husbands, as they try to lead their wives, lead their families in the way of truth. I don't think it's any accident that Paul compares the husband and the wife, their relationship, to the relationship between Jesus and the church. You see, Jesus is our loving leader. The church, we submit to Him. And Paul makes that observation. His love was sacrificial and purposeful. Church is referred to as the bride of Christ in other passages. We need to understand, Jesus didn't die just for the church. Hebrews says that He tasted death for every man. His sacrifice has as broad an application as those who are willing to accept the offer of grace that's extended. The ones who will receive the benefits of His sacrifice are those who do accept that offer. And that's the church. That's His called out people. That's Christians. Is that you? For those people, His death means sanctification. It means purification. It means cleansing from our sins. This morning, if you're not a Christian, why would you not submit to the loving leadership of Jesus Christ? Be baptized into Christ, as Paul describes that action, immersed in water for the remission of your sins, that you can establish this relationship with Jesus Christ as part of His church, as part of His chosen people. If you've not been baptized into Christ this morning, then we want to encourage you to obey the gospel, expressing your faith in Him and submitting to His commands. And we invite you to do that this morning. If you'll come to the front, we'll assist you. Why wait? Why not today while we stand and sing?